Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation. But we begin back in the movies, at least the television movies, with a crisis of both life and death, terrorism and human rights in that rampaging series, 24.
The following takes place between 6 a.m. and 7 a.m.
America has been victimized again. Last night's terrorist attack in San Antonio is now the latest in this series of bombings that began 11 weeks ago in 10 different cities. Over 900 people have been killed thus far, and while no one is claiming responsibility for this wave of death, evidence points to Islamic militants. Here in Los Angeles, the mood can only be described as tense and fearful, as the Department of Homeland Security is urging all citizens to report without delay any suspicious persons or activities. We spoke with a department spokesperson who says, quote, "We don't want to start a witch hunt, but we would rather err on the side of caution than become the next target." He then went on to say that the vigilance of the public is our best line of defense against attack.
The latest series, 24, in which Jack Bauer saves America about every 20 minutes, as it was broadcast last year. The series was concerned above all, say the writers, with the conflict between state security clamping down everywhere, supposedly in our own interests, and the need, on the other hand, to maintain liberties so that the nation doesn't become as bad eventually as those who are ruthlessly attacking it.
Our country is under siege. Now, you're the National Security Advisor, Karen. Frankly, I'm surprised by your resistance.
These places that you keep building, they're nothing more than concentration camps.
Detention facilities. And the criteria for determining who shall be detained are very reasonable.
Reasonable? This revised plan of yours justifies locking up every American who prays towards Mecca.
That's a ridiculous exaggeration, and you know it.
Right now, the American Muslim community is our greatest asset. They have provided law enforcement with hundreds of tips, and not a single member of that community has been implicated in these attacks.
So far, Mr. President, the people are losing faith in our ability to protect them. We've got to do something about this now.
The tension between protection and liberty as displayed on television in the series 24 last year. This year's series has been stymied, by the way, by the writer's strike in the USA. And so to our guest this week. She's Beverly Gage, Professor of Modern History at Yale University in Connecticut. And she's been studying an event that preceded the series 24 and September 11 with much the same consequences. She's with Alison Lee.
All right, so Beverly, your book, which I believe the title is The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in Its First Age of Terror. I think I probably represent your average bard. We thought that the first act of terror in America was 9/11. You know, we're ignorant of American history. I want to talk to you about what happened in Wall Street and when it happened, and I also want to talk to you about why you wanted to write the book. But let's start anyway, first of all, with the incident itself. Tell me about what happened and when it happened.
Well, my book, The Day Wall Street Exploded, explores what I think even for Americans is a relatively unknown event today, but was in 1920 one of the most dramatic events of its age. On September 16th, 1920, just after noon in the financial district in Lower Manhattan on Wall Street, a horse-drawn cart pulled up near the Stock Exchange and the bank of J.P. Morgan and Company, which was at that moment by far the most powerful bank in the world, and it exploded. It exploded into the lunchtime crowd on Wall Street, and it killed about 40 people, injured several hundred people, shut down the Stock Exchange, the Morgan Bank, the entire U.S. financial district that day. Districts in other cities began to shut down, Pittsburgh, Chicago, San Francisco. And it became this great mystery of 1920. The mystery was first what exactly had happened, and once it was determined that it was a deliberate bomb attack, of course, who had done it. And so that's the story that my book tells, is the story of this unknown today event from 1920.
Did they ever find out who did it or why they did it?
Well, it remains an unsolved mystery of sorts. There were many suspects at the time. It was a really massive criminal investigation. But one of the things that my book tries to do is look not just at this event, but at a whole history of terrorism from this period, which was shaped by revolutionary left-wing politics. So from the Haymarket bombing of the 1880s through a whole series of other kind of sensational acts of bombing and dynamiting, most of the suspects, and often quite rightly, though not in every case quite rightly, were anarchists, labor radicals, members of the industrial workers of the world, and other kinds of left-wing revolutionaries during this period throughout Europe, as well as in the United States. You know, terrorism was a tactic very heavily discussed by anarchists in particular, discussed a lot more often than it was actually used, but sometimes used as well.
So you're referring to a number of events that happened here in America. I don't pretend to be a connoisseur of American history, but I've never heard of these things. Am I unusual, or would that be the norm amongst, you know, most of the general public?
I think you're absolutely typical. In fact, the way that I got into studying this event was simply from the impulse that I had never heard of this. It was actually before 9/11, and I was living in New York, and I was flipping through a kind of general history book that had a couple of sentences about the fact that a bomb had exploded on Wall Street in 1920, killing all of these people. And I thought, really? I have no idea what that's all about. And so even for me, that was really the source of my exploration. And I started with that one event. But as I got into it, I discovered there was this whole lost history of bombings and dynamitings and assassination that even in the early 20th century was talked about as a kind of terrorism. One event, the Haymarket bombing of 1886, famous trial in Chicago in which 8 anarchists were convicted not of having thrown a bomb that killed several police officers during a labor demonstration, but of having incited someone to do it through their revolutionary language and rhetoric. Another incident, huge event in its day, now almost forgotten, is the dynamiting of the headquarters of the Los Angeles Times in 1910, in which 21 people were killed, bomb went off overnight, the building caught on fire, and 21 men working on publishing the paper were killed. And that bombing was traced to a pretty mainstream labor union, actually.
So you were writing about this and thinking about this actually before 9/11.
I was writing about it and thinking about it. In fact, I had just acquired the FBI file, what was then called the Bureau of Investigation, but thousands and thousands of pages of documents, many of them still heavily marked up with names blacked out, even almost 100 years after the fact, to look into this event. And I was living in New York, as I said, and watched 9/11 unfold. And it was really, you know, it was very dramatic on any number of levels, right? A personal level, a national level, all of that to be here and to be experiencing that. But in addition to what so many people were going through with 9/11, there was also this kind of sense of the uncanny. It was just a few blocks away from where this earlier bomb attack had happened. It reopened the stock exchange on the same day, 81 years later, right? I mean, so you saw a lot of similar language, similar questions about balancing security and liberty, similar concerns about immigration, even though these two political contexts are so vastly different, right? The difference between kind of revolutionary anarchists of the early 20th century and a group like Al-Qaeda, in some sense, right, couldn't be more profound. And yet some of the social responses are not all that different in certain ways.
So, in fact, do you think it's useful to draw comparisons between, you know, the then and the now?
It is useful. I think the simple fact that, you know, terrorism was not born on 9/11, and understanding that there actually is a history not only to terrorism as a tactic, but also to the ways in which societies have responded to the problem of terrorism. Obviously, the scale is very, very different. The technology is very, very different. And the politics, I mean, the political context of all of it is very, very different. But there are certain common questions, right? Not only the fact that terrorism is not born anew, but the fact that these questions about civil liberties, about free speech, about immigration, about the power of the federal government, about whether to treat these as criminal acts to be tried in a court of law or as some sort of much broader ideological war that needs to be controlled in other ways, all of these were very, very pressing questions 100 years ago as they are today.
Do you think that if the general public had been more aware that 9/11 was not an isolated incident, if we'd had a better understanding of history, do you think it might have changed the course of events after 9/11 and how it's all panned out?
I think it's hard to say, of course, right? Historical counterfactuals are always a little hard to say in a definitive sense. But I think particularly around the question of civil liberties and trying to strike the right balance, many of the stories from the past are stories in which there were massive violations of civil liberties that really did a lot of damage to American political culture. So I think in that sense, it might have been different. And I think in some ways, the kind of political currency that came out of 9/11, which was so much shaped by the idea that nothing like this had ever happened before, the idea that this was pure evil in its greatest manifestation, elements of that are certainly true, but it's also true that, you know, terrorism is a tactic. And it's a tactic that's been used by lots of different groups in lots of different ways over time. And so to try to understand it that way as well, I think gives a slightly more manageable framework than simply operating out of fear, although, of course, fear and evil are all important parts of the story, too.
So what other aspects of 20th century history do you teach at Yale?
Well, I like to joke that I teach all of the really controversial isms. So I teach about the history of terrorism in America. I teach about the history of communism and anti-communism in the United States. So radical movements, McCarthyism, those sorts of areas. And then I also teach a slightly more mainstream political history. I teach courses on the history of conservatism in the United States, as well as the history of liberalism in the United States. So I'm sort of the isms person, political ideas, political change, political conflict. That's really what I do.
Well, here's a thought. Did it ever occur to you, or perhaps you've even written about this, was it ever possible, perhaps, since they never found out, you know, who caused the Wall Street bombing, was it ever possible that perhaps that was a conspiracy that had been whipped up by the incumbent government to get people to be, you know, anti-communist?
Well, this was actually one of the big theories at the time, particularly on the left, and particularly because, in fact, throughout the late 19th and early 20th century, you had not infrequent episodes in which, you know, not only were these events kind of stirred up and made much bigger than they were by anti-labor elements or anti-radical elements, both in the government, in business, etc. But there were actual instances in which employers planted dynamite to frame up a labor union, instances like that. The other thing about the Wall Street bombing is that it came in the midst of what's known as the post-World War I Red Scare in the United States. So you had just had the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, in the midst of World War I. World War I has come to an end, and there's a massive, massive push to deport anarchists, communists in the United States, most famously in what's known as the Palmer Raids, which were a couple of huge deportation raids aimed at, again, anarchists and communists in 1919 and 1920. And so this was a moment when the question of, you know, how do you deal with revolutionary movements? What is communism going to look like in the United States? These are all open questions. And boom, in the middle of this comes this big bombing. And it's at a moment when that stuff's sort of starting to fade out. And so for many people on the left, it was quite clear that, you know, this had to have been a frame-up, an attempt by the Attorney General of the time to rehabilitate his reputation, an attempt by the government to gain new currency from anti-communism. And I will admit that I secretly hoped when I got the file that there might be a smoking gun in there suggesting that, aha, it was the Bureau of Investigation, particularly because J. Edgar Hoover was not the head of the Bureau at that point, but he was a young man. He was in his mid-20s, and he was there behind the scenes in all of this as the head of the Justice Department's Radical Division. This was how he got his start in American politics. So I hoped maybe there would be a smoking gun there, but alas, there is not. You know, it's still some, there were people who maintained to their dying day that it had been neither a conspiracy nor a deliberate act of terrorism, but was just an accident because they were blasting through Manhattan bedrock downtown and someone, you know, let the dynamite shipment go awry.
So I can tell by the passionate way that you talk about this topic that you're obviously very passionate about your history and about teaching history. What about your students? I mean, is there a passion for history, do you think, among young people in America?
There is. I'm not sure that my students are necessarily representative of young people in America, because I sort of by definition tend to attract students who are interested in history. They're not required to take my courses. Certainly at Yale, history is the most popular major on campus. So there are many hundreds of history majors who are going off into doing all sorts of things, going into politics, going off to law school, going off to medical school, other places like that. So I don't know that my students can be taken really as a representative example. I think there's sort of a paradox in the United States in a general way, though, which is that on the one hand, everybody sort of says, oh, Americans are famously ignorant about their history, right? Americans aren't interested in history. They don't want to know about it. On the other hand, you have a huge boom in this country in heritage tourism, historical tourism, genealogy, local history, all of these sorts of things. So there's something of a paradox there. I think people are interested in history when history is told as good stories that are meaningful in the present day. So I think it's the challenge of the historian to make people interested in history.
How important do you think it is that they should be, that people should be interested in history? I mean, for example, in Australia, we have recently had an edict from our government, or at least the government that we did have, because we've just changed government, but the government wanted to impose a history curriculum on all schools. Now, do you think that's a good plan?
I think there are lots of dangers in government-imposed history curriculums, because you get into questions of whose history is being taught, toward what end, with what aim in mind. And so my impulse is that the teaching of history is good. I'm not sure that a standardized government-sanctioned history curriculum that everyone has to be taught is really the way to go.
So tell me about you. What gets you up in the morning? What drives Beverly Gage?
Well, I have to finish writing that book, so I have to get up each morning, and my four-year-old wakes me up each morning very, very early, though we're trying to teach him not to do that. I guess what really drives me is trying to get a sense of the ways in which, you know, history has shaped the world around me. I actually started out as a journalist out of college, as a reporter, doing lots of stories on contemporary politics, on prisons, on all of these sorts of things. And what I found as a reporter, and the reason that I decided to go back to graduate school in history and become a historian, is that as a reporter, I got to kind of skim the surface of what I saw in front of me, but I didn't get a deep understanding of how those things had come to be. And that really has always been the question for me as a historian, is taking something that I see in the world that doesn't make sense to me. Some political idea, some strange event like the Wall Street explosion, where you say, huh, I don't really have a way to understand that, and going and searching for its roots and searching for explanations in the past. I mean, to me, history is very much alive. I see it everywhere. I walk down a street, and what I see is the sets of human decisions that made this become what it is. And that is all that history is the things that people have decided to do, the ideas that have driven them, that have shaped the world as we see it.
Your book about the Wall Street bombing comes out in early 2008. I hope we get it in Australia pretty soon. What next? What's your next book going to be?
I think, and it has not yet been started formally, but I think it's going to be a biography of J. Edgar Hoover, who was the very famous head of the FBI in the United States for almost 50 years, so from 1924 to 1972, until he died in office. And Hoover is a very famous figure. Obviously, I mean, he certainly is in the States. I don't know if he is in Australia, but I suspect he's gotten around, right? And what I want to do with Hoover, there are lots of books already there, but, you know, since his death in the 70s, he's kind of emerged as the great villain of American history, and there are lots and lots of ways in which that is true. But really, the primary approach to him has been to, you know, kind of expose what it was that he was doing behind the scenes, tell the secrets that J. Edgar Hoover never wanted you to know. And I think in some ways it means that we've lost sight of the fact that he was beloved, he was admired, and he was this major, major political force in the U.S. throughout most of the 20th century, possibly the most powerful political figure in the U.S. at certain points in time. So I want to go back and look at a little bit of his public self, and particularly look at the ways in which during this period that's usually thought of as kind of the great liberal age in America, Hoover was this kind of pretty profound force for conservatism.
Yes, and J. Edgar Hoover, once revealed in another biography, was fond of dressing up in ladies' clothing and went off to certain parties. Didn't stop him persecuting gays, however. Strange man. That was Beverly Gage, Professor of Modern History at Yale University, with Alison Lee, a former executive producer of Catalyst. They were in New York. Next week, we're back to nature with Lynn Malcolm and a conversation about hotspots, featuring one of my favourite birds. I'm talking about the kakapo.
Can you just describe the kakapo?
Well, the kakapo is a giant, flightless parrot that's endemic to New Zealand. It is critically endangered. There's only 86 left in the world. They are the heaviest parrot in the world. So males approach 4 kilos, and females can get up to around a 2 kilo mark. The kakapo is the only lek parrot. The term to describe the breeding system is lek. And basically what happens in lek species is that there are no pairs as such. What happens is that the males generally congregate and perform some kind of display to attract females to them. And they'll try and attract as many females to them as they can and mate with as many females as they can. So the males are basically just sex objects. They play no role in parental care whatsoever. And after the female mates with the male, she goes away and raises the young all by herself without any male involvement. And that's what kakapo do. It's a highly unusual system for any parrot. Most parrots do form a pair bond, and males play a role in parental care, but the kakapo is the exception.
And they have a very distinctive call, which is incorporated into the mating, isn't it?
Yeah, typical of a lek species, males invest an awful amount in display, trying to attract mates. And kakapo, this consists of, firstly, they establish a display territory, which we call a track and bowl system. And this is usually up on a elevated ground, on a high ridge, you know, or the edge of a bluff, somewhere like that. And the birds will develop it over many years. And so you have these sort of depressions in the ground, which are called the bowls. And that's where the male will actually sit when he's doing this booming display, we call it. And the bowls will be connected by very well-maintained tracks so that he can run between his different bowls and get between them quickly. And they invest a lot of time in maintaining these tracks and bowls. And then once he goes up there in the breeding season, males will go up to their track and bowl system and they'll start maintaining it very early in the spring. And then moving into December, they'll start performing this booming call that you mentioned. And this is a very low-frequency call that carries in good conditions for, you know, maybe 2 to 3 kilometres. It's certainly audible to humans for maybe 2 to 3 kilometres under good conditions. And it's a very low-resonant call, something like someone blowing over the top of a very big bottle. And they puff themselves up with air to do this. They really put a lot of effort into this display. Normally in a good season, they'll start booming half an hour after sunset, and they won't stop till half an hour before sunrise. And they produce about, on average, you know, somewhere between 5,000 to 8,000 booms a night. So it's a lot of hard work.
Lynn Malcolm was in conversation with Ron Morehouse in New Zealand. The series Balancing Nature, currently on The Science Show, continues on Saturday at 12 after the news. Meanwhile, don't miss Catalyst starting on ABC television in a couple of minutes, with Jonica Newby risking her skin by descending into a volcano in New Zealand. I'm Robin Williams.
Thank you.
listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.